Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing U.S. Arms sales to Morocco and President Trump's recognition or reaffirmation of the initial recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Jacob Mondi, Associate Professor of Peace and Conflict Studies and also Director of Peace and Conflict Studies at Colgate University in New York. Jacob, it's a pleasure to have you join me today. And I look
it's
forward
great to be with
to
you. The conversation. Thank you.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So I think recently, I think during spring this year, the US approved, the Department of State approved the foreign military sales to Morocco in the tune of approximately, I think, about $825 million. What is this? What is behind this approval? What is the relevance or implications of this?
Well, the United States has always had a longstanding military relationship with Morocco. This goes back to the closing days of World War II, when relationships were forged between the U.S. military and Morocco during the war against the Italians and the Germans. And from then onwards, we've had these connections between the US military, US intelligence, and the Moroccan military. Morocco during the Cold War was the largest recipient of US military materiel, second to Egypt. Egypt is in its own category, especially after the Camp David Accords. And so Morocco is really, if you put Egypt aside, the largest recipient in Africa of U.S. military aid. Most of that aid comes from the 1970s onward to help Morocco in its occupation of Western Sahara. And fast forward to the present, Morocco today uses this relationship, this arms relationship, as well as other forms of cooperation with the Defense Department as its primary sort of connection to the United States, that when Morocco feels that it needs attention from the US or it's worried about its position in the US, it will use arms purchases and things of this sort to kind of like keep the relationship alive in certain ways. I know we'll talk about Trump's recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Sahara in the years leading up to Morocco's receiving that recognition in 2020. Morocco went on a pretty unprecedented military spending spree in the United States, much larger than the figures that you were just talking about. So multiple billions of dollars, and that got the Trump administration's attention in certain ways. And then Morocco also joined the Abraham Accords. So Morocco uses these connections to Israel, to the US Defense Department, to maintain its basically, they might view it as an alliance with the United States. Mm-hmm. Morocco is a major non-NATO ally. That's an important defense pact that we have with Morocco in the United States. But more importantly, I think it's also it's basically a kind of patronage relationship that, you know, Morocco needs to maintain the United States as a patron of the Moroccan monarchy.
Mm. Beyond, we'll come back to the recognition, beyond the special relations and, you know, dating from the World War II. Also understanding how President Trump's kind of transactional relationship, foreign policy to come. What is India for the United States? Because from what you said now, I've not really heard much of why what United States stands to gain in that specific terms.
Yeah, with the relationship with Morocco. Well, I think there are a lot of different factors here. I think geostrategically, Morocco has always been viewed as a very important country because of its position globally at the mouth of the Mediterranean Ocean. And the one thing that, you know, Defense Department planners would never really want to ever consider is a hostile state that controls the state of Gibraltar. I mean, if you go back to the height of British imperialism, before or after the creation of the Suez Canal, trade coming from India, and this is where Gibraltar becomes really important, but also a colony like Yemen or Aden, you know, that these sort of these global choke points become very important for imperialism. And so that's the kind of importance that Morocco has, is that this kind of like geopolitical location. The relationship today with Morocco, with the United States, is really important. One, because of different things going on. There's, through the Abraham Accords, there's a consolidation of a kind of block of pro-Washington regimes in the Middle East, the ones that have signed on to the Abraham Accords. Sudan might be something we'd bracket off there, given what's going on there. And to a certain extent, the Abraham Accords were much more about building a coalition against Iran. So Israel, allied Arab states, confronting the axis of resistance. That's changed a little now that Israel has dealt serious strategic blow to the axis of resistance, but there's that. And then when we look at Africa, the Sahel region, right, we've seen a string of very nationalist regimes come to power through the military in the Sahel region. And that's really kind of freaked out American policy planners, the DOD, because those relationships with the Sahel states from Mauritania to Chad were kind of critical, not only for what was viewed as a kind of like, you know, trans-Saharan security, though, you know, these relationships seem to produce more insecurity than security, oddly enough. We can get into that dynamic. But the, you know, for the when the Africa Command was created, the U.S. Africa Command, right, it didn't really have a strong mission in Africa going into the global war on terror. And so so that mission had to be created to a certain way. And forging those counterterrorism relationships with the states of the Sahel was really critical. But what the U.S. ended up doing was creating resistance to imperialism in Africa through those relationships. Because by the end of, you know, the 2010s, I think a lot of people in the region were starting to really wonder, like, what are the French doing here? What is the U.S. doing here? They're not creating more security. So with the collapse of those relationships across the Sahara Sahel, again, France, Spain, the United States have turned to Morocco as a quote unquote bastion of stability in the face of these new challenges in the region. And so basically, what's happening right now, and why all this energy and investment is going into Morocco, is because you know, Northwest Africa is becoming a zone of resistance to the project of the North Atlantic powers.
Yeah. It's amazing you mentioned France, because this is, by the way, about 100 and something episode. In our episode 47, which was last year, we looked at the politics of recognition. I think it was France that was recognizing, was it the Pousseries or whatever in the Western Sahara? So we're looking at France at that point was recognizing the state. And we see again, I think India, you mentioned India earlier. India recognized the Moroccan kind of like maybe the autonomy of the region within Morocco, and we drew it in 2000. And then again, we have other countries, South Africa, Nigeria, that recognize the autonomy of this place within, as an autonomous state within Morocco. So what is the difference? And I think maybe it's the United States that have recognized Morocco's annexation of that, which is quite distinct from this autonomous. What is the distinction between, can you clarify this types of recognitions and the politics behind all these recognitions? I don't know if you understand my question.
No, I mean, there's multiple parts to the question, but in the 70s, when Morocco invaded Western Sahara in October, November 1975. So we're almost at the 50th anniversary of that invasion. The Western Saharan independence movement created a government in exile, the architecture for their own state, things of that sort. And a lot of countries, especially in Africa, began to recognize that government in exile as the true representative of the people of Western Sahara, of the state effectively in Western Sahara. A lot of those countries were more or less within the non-aligned movement, you could say. So even countries like Syria or Yemen, things like that. And India was one of the countries that did recognize Western Sahara as a separate from Morocco. And that recognition withdrew in 2000, which was sort of an index of the conservative shift or reactionary shift in Indian politics away from the progressive internationalism of Cold War to kind of this neoliberal thing that India has become today. And we've seen this de-recognition politics, so that states that previously recognized Western Sahara as its own thing and not part of Morocco have de-recognized. And so that was for a while, that was the politics of recognition in Western Sahara. But no country had ever gone so far as to say, we recognize Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. And so they would say, we don't recognize the Saharan Arab Democratic Republic as the representative, but they wouldn't say that they recognize Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. Then came along this weird kind of game that Morocco was playing, where they would get countries to create consulates in Western Sahara, and countries that have no citizens, in Western Sahara, or that who don't need consular services in Western Sahara. But again, you can have a consulate in a contested territory, for example, in East Jerusalem or something of that sort, without recognizing sovereignty one way or another. But when Trump recognizes through a proclamation, the Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara in 2020, it's the clearest any country has ever been on recognizing Moroccan sovereignty, and it kind of leads to this cascade of other countries following suit. It takes a while, but for example, we get a statement from Spain saying Spain is a little bit divided. It's the former colonial power, and it wasn't able to take as strong stance as it wanted. But Morocco was using pressure from migration, especially in the two Spanish enclaves in northern Morocco, but across the Strait of Gibraltar and even into the Canary Islands, Morocco can control that flow of migrants. And by controlling migrants, right, Morocco can increase the number of migrants, and that can increase the resistance to the center left government in Spain from dissident parties like Vox. And so Spain made this promise to Morocco that they would view, or from then onward they would say, autonomy is the only solution, which strongly implies that Western Sahara should be a part of Morocco. And then a year ago, we got the statement from the French. And so Macron said, we will effectively treat Western Sahara as a part of Morocco, and that with autonomy as the only possible solution. And again, it felt like they were splitting hairs in terms of the language, but effectively France joined the United States in saying that Western Sahara is a part of Morocco. Now, the context of that was negotiations within the French government to form a new government. And despite clear indications that, the people in France want a center-left government, Macron keeps trying to create center-right governments. And part of the deal with that was that basically Macron had to shift his North Africa policy away from reconciliation with Algeria towards embracing Morocco. That embrace of Morocco also has a lot of financial, developmental, infrastructural elements to it, especially as Morocco prepares for the 2030 World Cup, which is hosting jointly with Spain and Portugal.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. There's a lot of things we can get into now. I think we should get into, you mentioned Algeria there, because I know Algeria is also one of the contestants for the Western Sahara. How is that dynamics playing out with this recognition? Does it kind of further militarize that region?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things about the Western Sahara conflict is that it creates a sense of insecurity in the region. And it justifies arms sales to Morocco. It is the major source of disunity between Algeria and Morocco. The Algerians are a part of this conflict, but only to the extent that they support the Western Saharan independence movement. So unlike Morocco, they don't have a claim on Western Sahara. And so they're not part of the two parties to the conflict. Because they are a neighboring state, obviously they have a vested interest in all of this, and they have been the strongest supporters of the Western Saharan independence movement in Africa. Probably South Africa would be the second most significant supporter of Western Saharan nationalism on the continent. And that's partially because the apartheid regime actually supported Morocco, and so it gave Morocco weapons and to fight Polisario. And so that relationship between Algeria and Polisario, the Western Saharan independence movement, is really fundamental to this conflict. Now, the continued perpetuation of this conflict is a part of what makes this region viewed as insecure to some extent, because of there's a low level amount of fighting that's going on in the territory that, you know, in 2020, Polisario decided to break with the UN ceasefire that was created in 1991 because of what they viewed as Moroccan provocations to push beyond what was the agreed ceasefire line in Western Sahara, and that Morocco had repeatedly violated that ceasefire line. And so there's a low level amount of fighting that therefore justifies a lot of the military equipment, training, cooperation with Israel that Morocco is now pursuing, whether it's like in terms of drones or technology or with training and defense and things of that sort. And the fact that Morocco is now closely collaborating with Israel makes Algeria feel very insecure. To see Morocco developing as basically an Israel proxy on Algeria's western flank, that is strategically very uncomfortable for the Algerians, if not intolerable for some reason. The Algerians, for their own reason, but have always felt that they were possible target of foreign intervention, regime change, things of that sort. France has always had a difficult time reconciling itself with the fact that Algeria became independent in 1962. And Algeria has always pursued a very independent foreign policy, one that was neither pro-Soviet nor pro-West, very much with the non-aligned movement and things of that sort. But when you begin to see in the 2000s these regime change wars, so Afghanistan, but then Iraq, and then in 2011 in Libya, which really began to frighten the Algerians to a certain extent because it was right on Algeria's Saharan borders. And seeing that, you know, there was these aggressive Western wars against Gaddafi in Libya, Assad in Syria, and elsewhere around the world, that has really reinforced the Algerians' sense that they need to pursue an arms buildup of some sort to protect themselves. And so Algeria, with its oil wealth, has one of the most developed militaries on the African continent. And, you know, the more that Morocco embeds itself with the Abraham Accords and allies with Israel, the more that's just going to fuel the Algerians' kind of push for more national security. And that's just going to decrease regional security, right? Mm. Because the Moroccans are going to, you know, every time Algeria, you know, buys a new kind of like group of Russian jets or something. Morocco goes, oh, well, we need the F-35. We need more F-16s, or, you know, so it's an arms race, right? We have an arms race.
Okay, go on. Sorry to cut you off.
No, go ahead, yeah.
Okay, speaking of that militarization, you mentioned, how does that interplay with the kind of like geopolitical competition? So I'm guessing Nigeria is not going to the West for its weapons. Okay. So maybe there's China in that race, there's Russia in that race. How does all of that, you know, China, US race or fight interplay with all of this going on?
Yeah, I mean, Algeria probably sees the BRICS as the kind of future of global leadership. I mean, when the British also became the latest country to recognize Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara, or at least to say that autonomy is the only solution, when we look at the Security Council, there's only one country now that is credibly neutral on the question of Western Sahara, and that's China. Right. You know, the country that is credibly possibly the last defender of international law with respect to Western Sahara on this issue is China. And we might say to a certain degree, probably Russia, in terms of the permanent five members of the Security Council. France, the U.S. And Great Britain now all recognize Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara to one degree or another. So they're no longer credibly neutral in any way on this issue. And I think that speaks to the idea that, you know, as far as Algeria and a lot of the global South is concerned, China is the future of like credible global leadership. And so that needs to be taken into account in certain ways. Now, both Morocco and Algeria, have like trade with China and things of that sort. Algeria was a little bit ahead of the game just because of its economy. Was more independent of the Francophone sphere, right? So France and Spain are still the predominant trading partners with Morocco in that kind of like neo-colonial relationship. Not as bad as is the CFA zone, the currency zone that France has, but still very much locked in with those trade relationships. And recognizing Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara was a part of consolidating that relationship on the part of Spain and France. Now, Algeria is, there's sort of a saying like, you know, friendly with everyone, friends with no one, as far as Algeria goes, but sort of like, you know, willing to work with anyone on equal footing in that respect. But of course, their military is heavily Russian in that sense, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're pro-Russian or things of that sort. But yeah, I think if we can attribute any kind of like long-term thinking to Washington these days, which is very difficult, or the North Atlantic powers who seem to be very reactive and just, you know, who knows what they're trying to do these days. But yeah, this concern that basically an alternative to the North Atlantic world is developing. And so how is that going to be countered in some way? And so the Abraham Accords is a part of that, right? But the Middle East, right, it's so interesting because, you know, the Obama administration, the first Trump administration, the Biden administration, they all said that what they wanted the most in terms of foreign policy was to get out of the Middle East and then pivot to Asia. And yet at the end of the day, really stuck in the Middle East.
And that is what is very interesting. That's going to be my next question, to look at the continuum from Obama to Trump's first administration, then Biden. And has there been consistency in terms of, let's talk about Morocco now and its recognition. So what did Biden do? Because Trump, it was during Trump's first administration that he recognized Morocco. Did Trump carry on Biden administration maintain that? You know, why didn't they challenge that? What is the you know, if there was any differences in that? I wanted to know that in terms of, you know, the long term thinking of the U.S. kind of foreign policy from the Democrats back to Trump and back to Biden, back to Trump. Do you think there's some kind of a threat that is
We now know that in the worst of what was happening in Gaza, that the Biden administration never felt compelled, at least at the upper level, at the level of the president, the White House, or Secretary of State Blinken, to say anything critical of Israel, even when the rest of the world is screaming that this looks like a genocidal type situation. And so when the Biden administration inherits this, remember that, when Trump recognized Moroccan sovereignty or Western Sahara, this was December after he'd lost the election, so it was a very last minute decision. But by linking it to the Abraham Accords, there was sort of an understanding that, well, Morocco is only in this because of the Western Sahara thing. Yeah. And so if Biden says, well, we support the Abraham Accords, but we don't support what Trump said about Western Sahara, then Morocco is going to pull out of the Abraham Accords make it very difficult. And so after reviewing the issue, the Biden administration makes the fateful decision to uphold the recognition of U.S. of the United States recognizing Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. So that was, in a long history of basically Western powers squandering leverage over Morocco. This is the latest iteration of that, where, they could have said, if you engage in good faith political dialogue with the independence movement and achieve a just lasting and durable resolution to Western Sahara conflict, that's what the UN calls for right now. We will make this official in some way or something of that sort, right? Instead, they do the politically dumbest thing, and they say, well, we're going to maintain the recognition, but we'd really like it if you engaged in a peace process, that sort of thing. And so again, it's a sort of this, if we go back to like 2000, the UN was about to hold a referendum on independence, but then the King of Morocco died and Mohammed VI, the current monarch, comes to power. And instead of using that leverage to say, we would really like to see a referendum unless you're willing to make compromises, what they do is they take away the referendum and say, we really hope that you make compromises. And so they always take away the stick, dangle these sort of like, rotten carrots in front of the peace process.
Speaking of sticking carrots, so and then linking it back to the Abraham make a call, and we've seen with Israel, you talked about Israel as well. Yeah. And how even till now we see like the Western states are kind of like breaking ranks. We see the United Kingdom, we see Canada, Australia, France recognizing Palestinian states, and I think it's only the US that is still standing. How does that shift anything in terms of and then again linking that to the expansion in BRICS, in the BRICS kind of like network. I'm looking at the United States. No, not just the United States. The United States, I think the United States is the only one that hasn't recognized Palestine, Israel's Palestine. Yeah. So what do you think? Do you think that has any effect on the Abrahamic Accord or anything? Israel's kind of like.
I mean, it's interesting to look at just in terms of, Israel must. Or at least the mentality in Washington is that Israel is so important to the architecture of, U.S. global predominance that even when the world is screaming, for a two-state solution and an end to the genocide, Washington is dragging its feet, and again, we have to remember this is both the Democrats and the Republicans. Biden didn't say anything. When he had the opportunity, didn't withhold any military support for Israel, right? We could argue that, well, things are worse under Trump because it's more ideologically even more motivated. Like if you look at like, the ambassador is a, Mike Huckabee, who's like a Christian Zionist, And so, I think the crisis that we're in now vis-a-vis Gaza is an index of how important Israel is to the overall architecture of America's global supremacy, and how they're really just unable to imagine any kind of alternative to to how this would all work. This gets back to my previous point about why the United States keeps getting sucked back into the Middle East, even though they try to strategically disengage from the Middle East in one way or another. You know, this past summer, we saw the U.S. bomb Iran, you know, something that, you know, has been, you know, on the table for at least 20 years for the neoconservatives and things of that sort. So crisis, right, is always danger and opportunity. So what's going to happen in this situation where the world is saying they want a Palestinian state, they want an end to this conflict, and the Trump administration is just really doubling down on the old relationship between the United States and Israel. You know, and in the U.S., this is going to break the Democratic Party to some degree as well, right? Sort of this the big.
I mean, I think that it's quite important as well. Is we've seen some danger. Let's go to Russia in Ukraine. They have their next Crimea in 2014 and the current ongoing stuff. And we've also seen where, with the recognition of Morocco by Western Sahara, and then also Trump talking about annexing, was the Gaza and other places as well. Do you think this emboldens authoritarian governments across the globe where people can? Then, you know, people that are supposed, let's say the United Nations now is like, is powerless to intervene in this instance. And even the United Nations Security Council seems to be compromised. And a lot of people are calling for reforming all of that. Do you think there's a vacuum in terms of leadership to deal with security issues all around and how authoritarian governments are involved? How does these actions of recognitions or whatever complicate the Russian-Ukraine fight and, you know, elsewhere as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a legitimacy vacuum. I think the hypocrisy has just gotten to a point where it's so naked and so blatant in terms of what's going on with support for Israel, you know, that it was worse to a certain degree with the Biden administration, because the Biden administration was very sanctimonious about international norms and the rule of law and in the UN system and things of that sort. But what country in the world has used its UN veto more than any other but the United States to protect Israel, right? In a prolonged occupation, right? Annexation, things of that sort. You know, it's never been at the point where the United States has had to use a veto in Western Sahara. Once the UN mission is created, it becomes kind of the opposite dilemma, which is everyone wants to keep the UN mission in Western Sahara because it provides cover for the Moroccan occupation, especially after 2000, when, as I mentioned, they abandoned the referendum effort. And so, we see this hypocrisy in terms of we've seen this with like Kosovo in terms of, you know, different kinds of recognition, and then again with Crimea. How can the United States credibly say we oppose aggression, illegal annexation, things of that sort, when that's exactly what Morocco has been doing in Western Sahara since 1975, with copious amounts of U.S. military support, development support, things of that sort, diplomatic cover, you name it, right? And it's a very bipartisan kind of history of like Democrats and Republicans. There's not much alternation there. But the thing is, we often don't see countries bring up Western Sahara as a kind of case study because it's just not well known, right? So when countries are saying, well, normally I would, you know, denounce Russia's actions in Crimea and Eastern Ukraine, you know, but you know, because of Western Sahara, it seems a little hypocritical to me, right? But people don't know about Western Sahara enough to kind of like bring that kind of issue to the fore. And in terms of China, I think China might have moral credibility on this issue to some degree, but they're clearly very reluctant to assert themselves in conflicts. So they also have a strong standard for non-intervention. In situations, they will come in. So, for example, in the Saudi Iran deal, they will come in and help foster an already ongoing dialogue process, and things of that sort, right? But you know, for them to assert themselves in an issue like Western Sahara is just not part of their MO as a state actor right now.
It's interesting you mentioned Saudi and all the we've seen them taking all the middle powers. We've seen them taking sort of leadership roles in terms of all these conflicts. We've seen it in the DRC. Yeah. It was Qatar that negotiated the DRC, whatever, Congo. And so what do you, what are they called now? Is it the Arab League or all of those people? How are they dealing with the issue? And that's on one end. And also the African Union. How's the African Union? They've always had this kind of unsure, mixed kind of like recognition or whatever. How are they dealing with the current situation?
Yeah, very, very different approaches in the African Union and the Arab League. Personally, what's happened in the Arab League is we've seen, since the Western Sahara issue emerges, first as a problem of decolonization with Spain in the 1960s, but then as a conflict between the Western Sahara nationalist movement and Morocco going forward, Western Sahara becomes an issue that's championed by Algeria and progressive states like Libya and Syria to some degree. And it's really kind of, when you look at it, it's really that divide in the Arab world between the monarchies that are naturally conservative and to a certain degree feeling very embattled. The Libyan monarchy is overthrown in 1969. The Moroccan monarchy barely survives two military coup attempts in the early 1970s. And in fact, that's part of the motivation for Morocco to seize Western Sahara, is basically to try to galvanize the country and win support for a foreign conflict against Spain that would re-legitimize the Moroccan monarchy. Because most people assume that the Moroccan monarchy wouldn't survive the 1970s. It was just the wave of coups and nationalisms and Arab republicanism just seemed kind of unstoppable. But we saw with the Black September events in Jordan, right, a line begins to be drawn that stopped the wave of republicanism sweeping the Arab world. And then in the Iranian world, the Persian world in 1979, we see kind of like the last of the great Middle East revolutions. That the same year, there was also an attempt to overthrow the Saudi monarchy as well in 1979, and uprisings and the seizure of the Grand Mosque and things like that. So Morocco benefits from the increasing solidarity of Arab monarchs. And Saudi Arabia subsidizes Morocco's war in Western Sahara from 1979 onward to the tune of several billion dollars a year, which helps buy U.S. military aid and things of that sort. And a lot of that has to do with reaction to the Iranian revolution. The sort of like they see this, what's going on, and they're kind of freaking out. And so Morocco views itself as, you know, Arab to a certain degree, but Arab monarchism becomes an important defining feature. Now, the monarchies obviously get when we enter the period of the Arab Spring, then these like new divisions emerge between like, say, pro-Muslim Brotherhood monarchies like Qatar, and then the UAE, which is opposed to this kind of populist Islamism, right? And they fight it out in Libya, they fight it out in Syria, and then, like you mentioned earlier, Saudi Arabia takes it to a new level with U.S.-supported military intervention in Yemen from 2015 onward. The Arab world has basically been divided on this issue. But because we've seen the power of the monarchies increasing and the decline of Arab republicanism, right, with the recent revolution, if you want to call that, the recent coup in Syria, right, it's kind of like the most recent index of like the decline of progressive Arab socialist republicanism. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the African Union or the Organization of African Unity beforehand, right, totally different picture. By the mid-1980s, they recognized Western Sahara as a full member state, and that status is transferred into the African Union. And Morocco withdrew from the Organization of African Unity in the 1980s in protest. And they actually tried to take several countries with them to destroy the organization. Morocco felt that they could get a boycott, especially of the French-aligned states that would support them in their boycott of the African Union. That doesn't work. Morocco becomes the only African country to abstain for such a long period. And then by 2017, Africa realizes that the strategy has not borne any fruit. And so they go back to the African Union to try to undermine Western Sahara from inside. But again, when we think about it, we talked earlier about the politics of recognizing and de-recognizing states. One of the funny features of international law is it's very rare for a state to become de-recognized. You can recognize different governments and things like that, but once a state enters into the international system, it's there, right? And unless something like Yugoslavia happens, or there's a peaceful merging of two states, which is really rare, we don't really see that happen that much, right? Or South Sudan, a consensual separation of states following a very, very long and bloody civil war, right? But otherwise, once a state enters the international system in some way, then de-recognizing it doesn't really work, right? The African Union has no mechanism, right, to de-recognize a state, right? So what is Morocco even trying to do there? And then Morocco's presence in the African Union has become wrapped up in these efforts of Israel to have observer status in the African Union. And we've seen the African Union try to block Israel's participation.
Let's come to the last question. So I'm gonna give you a wide range to talk about a wide range stuff. So now we've seen, you mentioned the Saharan state, and we see some sort of anti-French, by extension, into Western populist movements that overthrew French and some American troops in the Sahara. Which is more like, we'll say, maybe it's like the African Spring, the Arab Spring. And then you had the boycott of some states, you have another alliance of states. And then you're seeing Trump administration again trying to renegotiate security cooperation with the alliance of Sahel states. So if you look at all of this, what do you project in terms of militarization, conflicts in this state, and some sort of stability, or what do you see? What can you project?
Yeah, well, I'm not very optimistic, because I think what's happening in the world, a few things, but I think global warming and a lot of what Trump seems to be doing, and I don't think this is intentional, but maybe it is to some degree, but is to distract us from the need for a global collective response to global warming, which we're not seeing. And if a certain amount of warming is already inevitable, which is what the science is telling us, then a lot of the tropical regions of the world are going to become effectively uninhabitable to some degree, right? And if we don't think about mechanisms of cooperation, allowing for migration, right, technology transfer, rapid carbon removal, like that seems like a pipe dream, but we're going to enter a world where human movement is going to become a necessity for survival. Besides the fact that the global north has been draining wealth from the global south for 500 centuries at least, right? So there's a question of justice there. Who built where did the wealth come from that built the beautiful Paris and things like that, or Amsterdam, things of that sort, right? But these are kind of like the big questions that we're really not talking about, because we're sort of, is the Wagner group in Northern Mali, or, these kind of like these kinds of little issues. And I think, again, it's there is a kind of maybe a global leadership vacuum, because we're in a period where Western legitimacy is now questionable. Bankrupt, right? Yeah. So what comes next, right? So there's always the kind of the Gramscian sort of moment where the old is dead, but the new can't be born, right? So what's the new, right? And I think the what comes next, is going to come from places outside of the North Atlantic.
Yeah. I agree with you. It's been an amazing time. We really, really enjoyed this. And you mentioned something earlier, and I was going to say we have two episodes on reparation. And okay. Funny enough, it was the last year. This year, the United, the African Union team was on reparation as well to talk about this, and then to link it to migration and all of that. So we live in an interesting world at the moment with the whole crisis, and like a lot of people would say, there is a leadership vacuum. People say we don't have the we don't have a hegemon. There seems to be a multipolar world, and we don't know what's going to happen. But like Riley said, China seems to have the potential to provide some kind of leadership. But anyways, it's been an interesting time. We really appreciate your time, and I appreciate your rich insight into the subject. And great. Thank you once again.
It was an honor to be with you. Thanks.
Thank you, and have a lovely, lovely day.
Oh, you too, yeah.
Thank you for tuning in to today's edition of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. As usual, join me to thank our guest, Dr. Jacob Mundi, for his rich and insightful analysis of the U.S. AMCES to Morocco and President Trump's recognition or reaffirmation of support for Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. Stay tuned, and I'll see you next week.